I talking to, man?
Yo, my name's DiMaggio.
DiMaggio?
Yeah.
That's your hip-hop name?
That's my MC alias.
How long you been doing hip-hop? I heard you spitting out here in the park. You guys sound good.
Oh, thank you, man.
Did I say that right? Spit?
Yeah, spitting some hot fire, as Dave Chappelle says.
I'm old school, man. The only thing I know is Eric B.
Eric B, man, Eric B and Rakim. I saw them last year, actually. Rakim played at Rock the Bell. Yeah.
Did he still do it?
Oh, yeah, man. He brought to me.
Microphone fiend.
Yeah, follow the leader.
A verified freestyle, lyrics of fury. My third eye make me shine like jury. You're just a renter rapper, your rhymes are minute-made. I'll be here when it fade, I watch it flip like a renegade. I can't wait to break and eliminate on every trade of a snake, so stay awake and follow, because the tempo's a trail. The stage is a cage, the mic is a third rail.
You guys sound good. Now, how'd you get started in hip-hop? How old are you?
I am 24. I started writing poetry, I guess, when I was in high school.
Oh, my love's like a red, red rose that's newly sprung in June.
I went to college in San Marcos, and there's a pretty big hip-hop scene down there, so I sort of just fell into it, fell in love with it. Then came up to New York and met this fool, Chris, who's on the drums right now.
Your drummer, listen to him for a minute. And he's from Iowa, I heard.
Yeah, hip-hop capital of the world, right?
Hey, Iowa's coming on, man. I'm kind of proud of those Slipknot guys. I know you probably don't like them. They took it all over the world.
They were successful in the music industry, which it gives them, you know, credit. I don't know if it's musical credit, but it's credit.
Girl.
We are, yes.
How long have you been hula hooping?
I don't know.
How did you get into it? It's an old fad from the 50s, I think. 50 years ago they started doing that, and here you are in the park with your hula hoops.
It was exactly 50 years ago that Wham-O had a big hit with the hula hoop. They sold 100 million of them, and WFMU started in 1958 as well, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
After the hula hoop fad died out, Wham-O introduced the frisbee.
What's the secret?
Well, I think the secret a lot of the time is the hula hoop you're using.
Is there different quality levels of hula hoop?
There are. These are both not very good hula hoops. I think, like, the heavier the hula hoop and the easier it is, and the size of the hula hoop really is dependent on a lot of things, actually, but I think like for smaller kids, using enormous hula hoops is harder, but it's a lot easier for them to use normal size hula hoops than for like normal size.
Is it
people.
Fun?
Yeah.
How old are you?
18.
High school graduating this year?
No, I got my GED.
Got your GED. Now what are you doing?
Nothing really.
Unemployed?
Yeah.
Looking for work?
Pretty much.
Living at home?
Yeah.
Not having much luck?
No!
Yeah.
Sending out resumes?
Not really.
Not really? Are the parents leaning on you now?
Yeah.
You gotta do something?
Yeah.
It's not a good feeling, is it?
No.
What do you want to do? If you could do what you wanted to do and get paid, what would it be?
Maybe be a teacher.
A teacher?
Yeah.
What would you teach?
History.
History. Louis, Jesus, I'm hungry.
Are you hungry, Colonel Clark?
Oh, Jesus, Dusty. I mean, Louis, I need a muskrat sandwich.
I think Sacagawea is making you a muskrat sandwich.
Is she gonna put a lot of birch oil on it, Louis? And a little cardinal lard.
Some cardinal lard would be perfect.
Yum, Jesus, Louis. Why do you like history? You're only 18 years old. You've only been around since, 1990 or something?
89.
Cardinal lard's good with bugles. Lou.
the bugle with Cardinal Lard.
Let down the hatch, Louis.
I think that history always repeats a cycle. It's like, You look at, the Depression. Right now, they say we're in a recession, and it could get to be the way it was in the 20s and 30s, and you look at the war we're in right
Warren
now.
Warren Buffett says we're in for a long, deep recession.
Way down.
Yeah.
Steve Perry is washing dishes at a Morrison's cafeteria in Scottsbluff, Nebraska. He's much heavier now, much older, mostly gray. His hairline's gone back quite a bit. He sports a little wisp of a beard, and he's dressed in some chubby man's jeans, a fog hat t-shirt, and old red chucks. He's virtually unrecognizable. His voice is hoarse, a whisper, blown out from endless gigs, cigarettes, whiskey, cocaine, and angry shouting. He has a little apartment over a sundry store on Lark Street. It's small but comfortable. He buys his groceries at the Get and Go on the corner. Frozen pizzas, microwave burgers, salted nut rolls, cans of Mr. Pibb. Nothing nutritious. He bangs away on an old light blue Royal typewriter trying to write his memoirs, but it's not going well. He has a mouse in a cage named Gink, and he likes to watch Gink run on his wheel. Sometimes Steve sings softly to him.
The wheel in the sky keeps on turning.
And Gink the mouse turns his wheel, and in those moments, Steve Perry is content. He still has some money, but not much. All of it sitting in the First Bank of Nebraska on Main Street. He thinks neither positively or negatively about Scottsbluff. He knows only that he is there, and that despite the constant wrestling with his memoirs, his life is much simpler now, more to his liking. He has a woman friend named Yvette, but she doesn't live with him. They see each other once a week, speak for a while. Sometimes they make love on Steve's blown-out brown Davenport. They don't do it without sentiment or caring. They think of each other during the week when they are apart. They buy little gifts for each other, cheap bracelets, little scrolls with horoscopes on them, things like that. They are both satisfied, so the arrangement stays in place. David Gates gets a lot of money from song royalties. He wrote a lot of popular songs, great songs like Aubrey, Baby I'ma Want You, Everything I Own, Diary, love songs that truly touched people. These days, David Gates sits in his RV and reads magazines before he goes on stage. His life has become an endless succession of casinos night after night because, well, that's where the money is. He's getting older. He's tired. But as his own song, The Guitar Man, says,
she's just got to find another place to play.
And that he does. His management sees to it and takes a sizable cut. And David Gates takes the gigs. He takes them, even when they're horrible, because he has to. It's what he does. And there are bills to pay, lots of them. He reads magazines, and he performs. And he does the math in his head, the bills, the days, the years, the horrible math of living. He puts on his silver vest and his hat with the conchos. Still an hour until he goes on stage. Still an hour. The winds blow out of the east, unusual, and he notices it. His back hurts as he walks across the yard to his art studio, a converted barn. John Cougar lives in Indiana, still lives there. He's got some of the same old friends, but they don't drop by much. Nobody wants to bother him. People mind their own business. He almost wishes they would bother him. He paints and he thinks. he thinks and he paints. He'd like to be thought of as more than just a pop singer. It's not like he wants to be Rembrandt or anything. He's happy enough in league with Antonio Benedetto, Red Skelton, Marilyn Manson. Painters, too, not just singers. Reflexively, he reaches into the breast pocket of his jeans jacket for a smoke. His current female fiddle player chastises him. You quit smoking, John. He ignores her as he adds another splotch of turquoise to a painting which features a clown in a shadowed room. A dolorous Emmett Kelly. Skeltonesque.
If this country is conquered by aggressors, there can be no other pilgrimage, or there will be no more free lands that they may go to.
John's grandson, Cody, likes to visit with Grandpa John. The last time they visited, little Cody told his grandpa proudly about how he'd stolen a Green Day album from the Ben Franklin and Seymour. Grandpa John put down his paintbrush and frowned. Don't ever steal, Cody, he says. And then he rustles Cody's hair and the love shows in his old rock and roll eyes. Don't steal, boy. It's wrong, okay? He goes back to painting his most recent clown, and Cody goes outside and swears and kicks a rusty old team can into the bushes. Grandpa sucks, Cody says, but he doesn't really mean it. Out in Nebraska, where the crushed yellow sunsets are choked with thick truck dust, where they want to run a pipeline into the sand and the last of the whooping cranes try to figure out a way to hang on. Lots of bathrooms out that way made of rough barn wood, and outside of them little mint green retaining tanks with brown streaks of rust escaping from their corroded seams. Was blowing from the east all across the nation. It was unusual. Perhaps that's why I had the sudden urge to head west myself, blown that way by the wind. In front of me, there, a car, a 77 Vega wagon, butterscotch colored. The keys are in it. It's idling. No driver in sight. I'm stealing it. I steal it. Luckily, it's full of gas, and I have a little cash in my pocket.
Ah, now.
Up the West Side Highway, across the GWB, hooked up with I-80, and I'm gone. After a little bit, I stop in Jersey and steal plates from another car in the parking lot of a gentleman's club, which advertises Home of the Bada Bing. Now it's raining and it's colder, and the gravity of what I've done begins to pull me down into fear and remorse. I fight through it mentally. It isn't easy, but a few miles down the road, I've regained my good feeling, that crazy feeling. Car thief, headed west. How quickly moods and even life can change. Sandy Nelson is old, really old, but he still plays drums. He bangs on them in his cluttered garage in California. As unlikely as it sounds, he is planning a comeback. Some of you younger listeners won't even know who Sandy Nelson is. Sandy Nelson. All those drum albums he made back in the day, like Teen Beat. There was a time when you wouldn't have just wanted that album. You would have needed it. Sandy remembers. He remembers how it was, and he wants it. He wouldn't admit it outwardly, but he wants it back, all of it. The music, the attention, the women, the parties, the fame. But now he's almost 70, and he's arthritic and half deaf, and As some of you may know, he lost his right foot in a motorcycle accident in 63. His looks are gone now, but he still tries to wear the latest clothes, the billowy shirts and colorful socks and a long white shoe. His hair, he still has some. It's all gelled up and spiky. A young look. He wants to look young so he can get back out there. He bangs on his old drum set, the last one he has left, a ramshackle slingerlet kit awarded to him by Liberty Records in 1965. He sold all the rest of his drums, the Ringo kit, the Fibes acrylic kit, even his favorite old snare that Bob Crane gave him. Sold them all, cheap, had to pay the bills, gas bill, rent, health problems, women, booze, he had to pay. He still does, so he practices all day and into the night, and the neighbors complain. They are over the fact that he was a star. He is now to them a loud, annoying old man playing slow off-tempo fusillades of tom-tom fills and hi-hat flourishes loud because he can't hear so well. This isn't a factual account of lives. But what if it was? What if it was so and he was still out there under that naked light bulb pounding those things? Pounding them, unable to capture old rhythms, the old sound. I was surprised I hadn't been pulled over. After all, a Vega wagon is not a common car to see on the road, and the butterscotch coloration was a dead giveaway. So where was the highway patrol? I'd stolen a car. Why was I not seeing flashing lights and cautious patrolmen sidling alongside the passenger side waiting for me to roll the window down?
I don't know.
Luck, I guess. Luck and destiny. Destiny is a strange thing, and I was feeling it. I am feeling it. I continue to feel its pull as the freeway unfolds before me. The road of freedom. Now comes Pennsylvania, Wilkes-Barre, home of the boys, Rupert Holmes. And I actually see Rupert in a Mr. Donut where I stop for coffee and to use the bathroom. Rupert Holmes, if you like pina coladas. I see him sitting there working on a laptop. He looks up for a second and he sees me. And then he looks away quickly. I think to ask for his autograph or to discuss earlier songs of his that I love, like letters that cross in the mail. But he is obviously unnerved by my attention, so I leave him alone. But it burns in me as I leave. I could have met him. I could have met him. Through the glass, I see Rupert walking toward the men's room. He has to go, and so do I. David Gates is appearing at the Dual Nations Casino in Wilkes-Barre, down by the river, cold down there. Not many cars in the parking lot, which to me is hard to fathom. This is David Gates' bread. All those hits, but hardly any cars. David is being roundly ignored up there on stage, playing for at most 50 people, and most of them are engrossed in their chicken marsala and salads that come with the show. Dishes clank and people talk as David goes through his legendary repertoire. Only Goodbye Girl seems to get a response from them. Figures that it would be one of his least favorite compositions. He made a load of money from it, but Goodbye Girl is one of his least favorite songs. In the same way that Paul Simon resents feeling groovy, David, unlike Paul Simon, sucks it up and plays Goodbye Girl, even extending it and allowing his half-in-the-bag keyboardist to take a long solo while David sneaks backstage for his nightly hostess fruit pie. He leaves a television on back there too so he can catch a bit of a show during the keyboard solo. Mannix is on, and David escapes momentarily into the fast-paced action of it. Get back out there. says he is a large, unfriendly man. Get back out there and play now. David does as the big man says. He performs a surprisingly tender version of Everything I Own that earns him yawns and looks of disinterest from the now 40 remaining audience members.
You sheltered me from harm.
No encore. Ordinarily, he'd walk back to his RV and fall asleep reading maybe a dog-eared issue of People in his little bunk. Only not this night, for I am there waiting in my stolen Vega wagon with the illegal license plates. I'm there waiting with the Vega idling by his bus. There's no security. No one cares. No one's waiting for his autograph anymore. Only time waits, trailing behind the easterly winds that sweep through the parking lot. Cold, foreboding winds. Only me, time, and the wind wait for David Gates. Mr. Gates, I say, and he turns around. Get in, I say. I push the passenger door open and motion for him to sit down. He does, and let me tell you, I am not surprised. Not a bit. Destiny. There it is. Big as this side of a barn. David is in, and we are gone. You didn't need any clothes or anything from the bus, I say, and he says no. Come to think of it, I don't have any extra clothes either. No extra anything save a little money and a dream that I cannot see or figure out. I am in it, and it is revealing itself to me, to us, this dream playing out in real time in real places like this, Wilkes-Barre, just like it did for Rupert Holmes and the boys. It's happening again, and it's heading west. Steve Perry drags himself out of bed at 6:30 in the morning, a cold, charcoal Scotts Bluff morning. The street cleaner went by an hour ago, and Steve had a dream about the street cleaner and its powerful rotating brush. He's lying on the road. It's approaching fast now, throwing up trash and dust and dead birds and bits of glass. It's loud and throaty and smoking and dangerous. He can feel it. He looks up in the dream and he can see the street cleaner driver in the cab. The driver is drinking from a brown bottle of strong alcohol. And he's so dreadfully drunk. And that coarse, painful brush is spinning just inches from Steve's face. It will scrape the skin from his skull. Then he wakes up. He wakes up and drags himself out of bed as reality takes over. He goes to the bathroom and not only pees, but unloads his entire burden. Surprising for this early in the day, but such a relief. Good. Good, Steve says. And it is. And he puts on his pants and his apron and his name tag, and he closes the door to his little apartment and locks it to keep out the thieves. Drug addicts, awful, stealing Scotts Bluff drug addicts. He knows they're everywhere, waiting to steal his meager belongings. Maybe they would find his secret trove of Journey memorabilia under the floorboards. He almost turns back, but he has to work. He has to work so he can buy Yvette an engagement ring. He's made a decision. David Gates is pretty good company in the Vegas. We drive west. He tells me amusing Mike Bott stories and offers me a section of a Kit Kat bar, which I refuse politely.
Aww.
I quit caring about nutrition some time ago, David says, after the Mana album. You remember that one? I do, I say, though I only know it by name. Tell me the songs on it, David says, testing me. I fake an answer. The Mana album had Diary on it, right? Wrong, 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 he says, and he hits the dashboard with his fist and clams up for a long time, maybe 100 miles, till we go past Lima, and he lobbies hard for me to stop at a Hampton there that he stayed in before. No, I say, we're not stopping. Again, David goes silent, but this time he sleeps. He sleeps and dreams an odd voiced dream. Pleasant enough vision, but even in sleep, David balls his fists and elicits little yips and moans. As he sleeps, I watch the road and the ditches and the turnoffs. I am tempted by billboards and the radio. I am tempted by myself. I am tempted by something I cannot see, nor do I wish to see it. Red and muscular, stinking and skinking and thrashing out there in the black night fields. We've still so far to go.
Yes.
We've still so far to go. Mellencamp, for that's what he calls himself these days, is up late, painting. We are still 200 miles away from him. He's listening to music. He has an old turntable in his artist space and a little stack of ring-worn records. He has a pair of old Sherwin Vega speakers and a realistic receiver. Sometimes he listens to radio out of Terre Haute or Indianapolis. Rock stations mostly, for even though he's no longer riding on the top of the charts, he pays close attention. Never know when an opportunity might arise, a major sporting event, a sudden wave of nostalgia. If he could get one of those rap guys to sample one of his big hits, he might still find his way back, back to the top and the sheer rush of it. He loves to paint, he does, and he loves the maturity it implies, but it cannot match the visceral thrill of the big crowds and the big sound systems. The little bastard still has the fire. Mellencamp adds a little brown to a tree. On a canvas on his easel, a little box elder crawls unnoticed across one of John's boots. The box elder likes the smell of human feet. Now it crawls over his sock, and John senses it traversing his hairless shin. He reaches down under his pants cuff and pinches the box elder lightly between his fingers. He walks to the door and releases the bug into the night and into the wind. As John walks back to his easel, he absentmindedly feels his chest. He had a heart attack once, a bad one. He hates feeling for his heartbeat, but it is a developed obsession, feeling for his heartbeat in the middle of a lonely old night. The heartbeat is there, but it's weak. The Vega overheats and we pull into a Gulf station, David Gates and I, about 30 miles east of Anderson, Indiana. With outstanding luck, we find a mechanic who's willing to look at the car. A crisp 20 ensures he will not document the repair in any way or ask too many questions. He adds a can of Bars Leak as I look on, and he says, "That'll get you a ways further. Radiator's pretty rusty. Take a couple of days to find one of those." We can't wait. We have to go. Wheels in the sky. Keep on turning. David mows down a plate full of eggs and potatoes, followed by a massive piece of coconut cream pie. I'm amazed that he's not fatter. He's a little fat, but in a, well, a respectable realm in line with his age. "Good," he says, wiping his mouth with the paper napkin. "That was good." I pay his bill, pay the mechanic, and we're back on the road. The light on the edge of the sky now as night gives up, the Vega running strong again, though I keep a watchful eye on its temperature gauge. Sandy finally tires of practicing drums and lays down his sticks. It's nearly midnight. He's been playing those drums for over 12 hours.
12.
Simple rhythmic patterns, nothing fancy. He keeps it simple. Driving. Once upon a time, it was more driving. Hell, maybe it never really was. The whole drum thing was new, and he was in the right place at the right time, Sandy Nelson. And he churned out those drum albums like nobody's business, till they couldn't even think of titles for them anymore, and they dumped him. Dropped him.
Okay. Well, goodbye, Otis!
He had to sell insurance and all of his drum sets and his old 67 Mustang 2+2 and his bull of a wristwatch. That was the hardest thing to part with. That watch, his dad gave it to him. And Sandy had to sell it. It hurt. And his leg hurts too, the stump, red and angry, rebellious and throbbing. Sandy lays down on his army cot and falls asleep, still sweating, still in his clothes, old worn denim shorts and a butterscotch-colored t-shirt. It was still quiet on the clean streets of Scott's Bluff, barely light. It was a 10-block walk to the Morrison's cafeteria, and the walk gave Steve time to think. Time to think that he kind of missed singing. But he missed Yvette more. Maybe he would stop by her place for a second, give her a kiss. It was on the way. But he sees a truck in her driveway, a big pickup truck with an STP sticker, a Thrush muffler decal, a gun rack. It makes him really sad. He keeps walking and the wind comes up out of the east, slow at first and then stronger, colder. A tumbleweed blows across the street, end over end, bound for who knows where. And Steve identifies. He feels like a tumbleweed, looking for a place to take root. He thought maybe he'd found it in Scott's Bluff, but then the truck, Yvette. He lowers his head and keeps walking. Surprisingly easy to enter John Mellencamp's property. There was no guard, no security, no cameras or monitors, no cop. It was easy, just drive on in and up the driveway, headlights still on, and Mellencamp sees them. He sees them with curiosity, no fear. He sees the lights and he does something simple and unfunny. He puts down his brush, considers his clown painting, and decides he doesn't like it. With a quick movement, he seizes it, raises it in the air, and brings it down over his knee, breaking its wooden frame and tearing the canvas. He crumples it and folds it and throws it in the trash. Then he shuts off the lights and he stands there in darkness for a moment until the approaching headlights of the Vega cast moving angular shadows across the walls of his painting studio. Mellencamp steps outside and waves hello to us. That's John Cougar Mellencamp, David says. It sure is, I say, and I keep the engine running as John ambles across the big yard and, without hesitation, climbs in the back seat. Where to? He says. I'm not sure, I say, but we're on our way. Sandy Nelson needs a bass player. Maybe he'll call one up. Fill out the sound. A real rhythm section. Why, back in the old days, he made albums that didn't even have bass on them, just guitars and drums. Bass was an afterthought, a luxury. Maybe he could get one of these young guys to jam with him. One of these beach kids with their long hair and lots of energy. He could start a band, make a comeback. He really believes he can do it, and sometimes that's enough if the wind is blowing in the right direction. He's no Ginger Baker, who, though riddled with emphysema and consumptive ways, can still flail away at a cream reunion and pack the O2, could still live in Nigeria with his young wife and sell polo ponies. Sandy can't do any of that. He can only pound stiffly on his slinger, let's trying simply to maintain his rudimentary foundation, the basics, his bread and butter.
Yes.
Still, maybe one of these young guys, he thinks, that's what I need. Coog and David are singing together in the Vega, some old song I don't recognize. And I find that as I drive, I seem to be fading somehow, becoming invisible, little increments. I'm only the driver now, the catalyst, the enabler. They keep singing weakly, showing their age and straining with their age-ravaged pipes. They swap old stories of glory and brag about current projects, alluding to future successes, which may or may not happen, but probably won't. On through Illinois and Iowa, faster, the car itself seeming to pale, now a dull yellow, and there is snow ahead.
We just got a new snowfall report in from Clarita, just about 2.5 inches down there, definitely more than that here in the metro, but again...
A light dish load today for Steve, not too busy, and what's this, a note on the bulletin board, Dick, call Neil, Neil Sean, he called. Steve is excited. He doesn't want to feel excited, but he is. By the way, Dick is what he calls himself in Scott's Bluff, and that's how people know him. They don't have a clue that he's Steve Barry. Not a clue, and he likes it that way. No, he's Dick Swain, and he digs into a little pile of breakfast plates with a hard scour and a little more elbow grease than normal. He'll call Neil at noon, he thinks. He'll call Neil, and Neil will tell him he's back in the band. For a moment, he forgets about Yvette and the big pickup in her driveway. He won't care anymore, right? Not now. He's going back with the band. Iowa. We're still in Iowa. Council Bluffs, Omaha, 66 miles, less than an hour away. The Vega is running strong, temperature holding steady. The strong winds blow the snow off the interstate, and our drive is so far unimpeded, though I do check the mirrors often for police lights. I'm in a stolen car with John Mellencamp and David Gates. Let it all hang out. Hombres on the radio now, and Coog is singing. David just laughs and eats. Laughs and eats. Turns out Sandy Nelson does find a bass player, and this bass player is no kid. He's a journeyman musician looking for a gig, anxious to latch on to any kind of star, no matter how dim, no matter how spent and relegated to the back shelves of popular memory.
I'll play for you, Sandy,
says Cort Peedles, former bassist of Pablo Cruz. Cort was not Pablo Cruz's original bassist, nor was he their current bassist. He played for them in some pretty lean years, 86, 87. Terrible years, really. Lots of county fairs and little TV shows. This was the pre-casino days, the pre-package tour days. Oh, he'd love to be with Pablo now.
Yeah.
But he jumped ship. When it got bad, bands don't forget that stuff. Pablo hired a new bass player, a younger one, a hot shot.
Hey, Pablo, everybody doing it right?
Cort tried to go solo. He went solo, he lost everything, his wife, his house, his kids, his car, everything, but his dream. And now it was hinged on Sandy Nelson. Sandy Nelson's crazy idea of a comeback. We're a team now, Cort, Sandy says. You and me, the rhythm section. I hope that means something to you.
It does, Mr. Nelson,
Cort says.
It does.
It was nearly noon by the time we got to Scott's Bluff, and we were hungry.
I know where we can eat,
David says. It's cheap and it's good.
Morrison's? Kook says.
How'd you know?
David says. I know them all, Kook says. We pull into the parking lot and walk inside. I don't say much anymore. I hang back, letting the legends be, minding the clock and the stars fading all the while. We aren't far from Joseph Dive Bomb Seiler. Joseph is in his parents' basement in Boulder, finishing a massive bong hit. He lives with his parents. He's almost 60 now, and his bedroom walls down there are still covered with posters. Martin Farner, Greg Jafria, Bob Welch in Paris, Quarter Flash. He was a roadie once upon a time, a guitar technician. At first, when he was young, he worked with Tommy Bolin and Zephyr right there in Boulder. That fell apart. Tommy left and got famous. Dive Bomb stayed behind. He had a girlfriend and a baby on the way, and he couldn't go. He couldn't, but oh, he wanted to. Eventually, he did get out of town when his marriage was over and his son was in junior high. He left town one afternoon in a stolen Vega. A brand new and butterscotch-colored 1977. He drove it all the way out to Flint, Michigan, and he worked for Grand Funk at the tail end of their better days. He loved Farner, even polished his chromium armbands for him and changed the strings on his vintage Bellino.
We are winners and losers.
Next came his move to New York in the 80s,
where he encountered the major acts of the day.
Bullet Boys,
Tony Hatch,
Paper Tiger,
Benny Vincent Invasion,
the Andrew Ridgely Project,
and Foreigner.
Tyler was burnout, broken, back in Boulder, back to the basement, for years now, just practicing down there. And now Dive Bomb Seiler was one hell of an unknown genius guitarist. He had learned much from his peers. He had watched from the wings, from backstage, and he had learned well how to make it scream and soar. A lead guitarist. He would tell people very specifically, I am a lead guitarist. That's him, I say, and Kook and David barely acknowledge my words, but they can't really hear me in a real way anymore. We're at Morrison's, and they say, that's him. And it was. It was Steve Perry punching the clock and ending his workday. Hey, Steve, David says, and Steve turns. David and Coog are not shocked by Steve's appearance. They expected it. They know how it is, what the rock life does to a body. They respect Steve Perry and all he gave, all he continues to give. Hey, Steve. He walks over and approaches the table. Some low words are exchanged, very quiet. Secret words? I don't know. I cannot hear the words. The conversation of the stars is now becoming hard for me to discern. By design, I think, I am slowly being removed from the equation. Steve just made the noontime call to Neil Sean. Things did not go well. No Journey reunion, no massive tour or massive paycheck. Just old tax issues. A thorn in Steve's side he can never seem to remove. He owes money. Lots of it, and Sean is mad, unforgiving. He bets with another guy. Nothing to lose. Steve gets in the back of the Vega by Kook and we leave. We stop by Steve's place and he sets Gink free. We leave Scott's Bluff behind and it fades in the rear view smaller and smaller until it never was at all. Though under the boards, the memorabilia remembers and waits for someone. Where to? Steve says. When we're 20 miles out of Scott's Bluff, the sky and the Vega blend into one. Vega. a faraway DJ on a station from Skimland. KWAY, Little Rock, Wo-Wo, and Fort Wayne, like that, distant, ghostly, fading in and out. Staticky, a voice.
Thirsty Forbert and Romeo's Tune on Quad 109.9.
Steve Forbert, huh? Coop says. I opened for him once in Saginaw. Nice guy. We drive on.
Meet me in the middle of the day. Let me hear you say everything's okay. Bring me southern kisses from your room.
Steve Perry says nothing. Steve Perry says nothing. He's pensive, missing Yvette probably, wrapping his mind around things. Sandy and Court Beatles sound pretty good together now. The neighbors stop complaining. There's cohesion, camaraderie, happiness. This is not a band, no, but it's rhythm section and a decent one. Not a great one by any means, not worthy of the big rooms, but it was coming together out there. Simple and plodding, but together.
This is so awesome. Mom, Dad, come down here and listen.
And of course they don't. Mom and Dad don't come downstairs anymore. They are ashamed of Dive Bomb Seiler, their son, and his failure. He has let them down. He has not succeeded, and he lives in their basement.
Come on, Mom. Dad, come down and listen to this. You listen to this.
Dive Bomb's dad says,
turn off that damn guitar.
Dive Bomb's mom adds exclamation.
It makes such a racket.
Dive Bomb stuffs the hurt and plays the lick again.
Oh man, after all these years of looking for the right notes and chords, and I found it. Mom, Dad.
It's like nothing he's ever experienced before. It's almost scary, like he was channeling those lost heroes. They were in him, playing through him, but he was there too, Dive Bomb was. He was part of the greatness.
What's all that noise?
Dive Bomb's dad says.
I can't hear American Idol.
Again, his mom complains. The rest of Nebraska passes by quickly. Flat nothingness. Impossibly beautiful, especially knowing what was to come, which I didn't really, but I did. I was the driver, drawn with invisible ink, vanishing on the page. But I hear them singing along with the car radio. I remember the song, a monkey song, Valerie. Coop takes the first verse and gets to it pretty good.
She's the same little girl that used to hang around my door.
His staccato brays of self-amused laughter are infectious until we're all chortling and chuckling. David laughs the hardest and longest. Maybe because he needs to laugh the most. Steve starts in singing, but then he doubles over in funny, high-pitched giggles that are as alarming as they are welcome. I laugh, and only the DJ on the radio hears me.
I hear you.
He says, in the voice of ancient, all-knowing rock and roll wisdom, as corny as that sounds, but he hears me, and I hear him, and I think to myself, this is what crazy people think, that the man on the radio is talking just to them. And it chills me a little. But I drive on into Colorado, past Julesburg and past Denver and beyond, up and up into the black night. Sandy tries to get a gig for he and Court Beatles. He tries the Thirsty Camel and the Hit Bag. Both turn him down. We remember you, Sandy, but you're too old now. No one remembers that music anymore. We've got new stuff, Sandy says. Good stuff. They turn him down. club after club, venue after venue. All his old haunts where he used to pack him in, the Troubadour, the Baked Potato. No one wants to hear about Sandy's new band, still he tries. Knocking on doors, asking for favors. Offering to sweep up or cut grass, whatever it takes to get a break. Because all he needs, all anyone needs in this world is a break. Gordon Peedles tries too. He calls up old friends, writes letters, makes phone calls.
Checky, can you help us out?
We're sorry, Court Checky, he says. I loved you and Pablo Cruz, but Sandy Nelson, yesterday's news. No, sorry.
Court Checky.
No way. Still at night, they practice and they get better. They're rhythmic, tight, personal bond growing, cementing. That really screwed that line up. Their rhythm is tight, their personal bond growing, cementing. They were now an inseparable team, bound by the beat and by the bass and by a love of the music, a kind of music that will never die. I used to think that I would never die. The days seemed so long and unending. The seasons passed slowly and I was young, strong, confident. But the years wear away at a person, the body and mind slow, time taking that toll. I am almost gone. I look in the rearview mirror as we pull into Dive Bomb Siler's driveway, and I'm barely there. Not there. I am a rundown poltergeist cruising the infinite for lost energy, rock energy. The hell's Dive Bomb Siler, says Steve, reluctantly hauling his big body out of the Vega. A little angry that he has to go down to the basement and watch this guy play.
Oh, Dive Bomb's my boy,
says Mr. Siler, suddenly proud, when he should have been proud all along. David doesn't like the elder Siler, and he gives him a wan handshake and turns his head. And then Dive Bomb plays. And all the legends drop their jaws in unison, his guitar plugged into an old 35-watt Magnavox, is huge in sound, spiritual and singular in its majesty. There is power and wild passionate fury. It is Dive Bomb Siler. He was playing like a god and was earning a spot in what was quickly becoming a band. 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 Me, I float in and amongst the beams down there with the spiders and the creosote ooze. Through pegboard holes, I hear the legends murmur. They accept Dive Bomb, exit the house, and walk towards the Vega. The Vega is full now, weighed down with four grown men and a spectral driver, alive on adrenaline and anticipation only.
Likes to use that partial.
Don't talk so much, Dive Bomb, Steve says, trying to sleep now. If I don't get any sleep, I can't sing.
Aw, hell, ain't none of us can sing anymore anyway, Steve,
Kook says, and then he laughs. But Steve's not laughing. Kook pulls his collar up and slouches down low in his seat. Soon enough, all of them are sleeping. And the radio plays, but no one hears. Or maybe they do. The way music seeps in through the ears and into the brain, gaining a foothold and not letting go, stored in memory for all time. Everyone knew head east, never been any reason. For parachute Colorado into Utah, past Bryce Canyon, Zion National Park, where 1,000 wild and beautiful creatures sleep, shooting wild brainwaves at the legends in the car, animalizing, imbuing them with even more untamed magic. I smile from a frozen star 10 billion miles away, driving the now white Vega on mind power alone, and it's all getting closer. My dream, my imagined realities, and Sandy's place, we are close now as the sun begins to rise, and Los Angeles surrounds the Vega and its waking occupants. Steve, the irritable, David, the hungry, Coop, the irascible, and Dive Bomb, the wild card. They wake and look out the windows, half amazed and half afraid. It begins to sink in. What have they done? Why are they here? What is the meaning of all this? Sandy's place is out by the ocean on a side street, run down, trash in the yards, old bikes and refrigerators with no doors, slack-jawed children with spittle trails and hard, coarse blankets, hollow-eyed, out-of-work men and big women with flabby arms, laundromats, chicken stands, broken surfboards. Sandy Nelson, baby. Sandy Teen Beat Nelson. Looking older than ever, bounding out of his front door, then limping gamely across the grass, arms outstretched, meeting his peers. Only David Gates doesn't like when Sandy calls him David. What about Mr. Gates? David says as Sandy pumps his hand, nearly sore. Sandy just looks at him and laughs, claps him on the back. Oh, damn. Hard enough to almost send David half staggering into a rusty swing set. My kids used to swing on that, Sandy says. I don't know where they are these days. Well, who the hell does, Sandy? Kook says. Who knows where them kids are these days? They sure as ain't buying my records. Everybody laughs, even Steve. And the mood lightens, at least until Court Peedles appears in the doorway with his bass. Who's that? Steve says. Sandy, that one of your kids? No, Steve, that's Court Peedles. Is that supposed to mean something to me? Steve says.
I played bass for Pablo Cruz,
Court says. And Dive Bomb's ears perk up.
Pablo Cruz, I worked for them in the early 80s, but I don't remember you.
I only toured for the Cruise Control album,
Court says, and Dive Bomb nods knowingly.
Oh, did you? Cruise Control?
Dive Bomb says.
I took off before that album. Pablo Cruz really went downhill after. I'm sorry.
Dive Bomb didn't mean to hurt Court's feelings, but he'd done it, and now Court had something to prove. Whipping his bass around, he readies himself to play. He begins. No amp or anything. He assaults the thing, working the fretboard until it almost smokes. He slaps and pops and grooves and does wild hammer-ons and things that leave the legends frankly speechless. Sandy just smiles, and the car doors open, seemingly of their own accord, but it is me opening them from a cave on the moon.
We chopped you down, Eagle.
Listen, the Eagle has landed.
I could open them from another universe if I wanted to, from any of a million universes, but there is one more drive to make. Sandy and Grant squeeze themselves into the cargo area. Sandy seems younger now, more alive. He looks younger. They all do. As if the joining together of all of them is tripping off some unseen triggers. A magic machine. A rock resurrection of some kind. All of them in that Vega, heading for the Sunset Strip. Heading for glory. The sun burns hot overhead and the crows make love in the air. Pools are evaporating, skin burning right off the bone. Warnings on the radio, hotter than ever, hotter than ever.
This is the longest 90-degree-plus temperature streak on record.
the Vega begins to struggle right there at La Cienega and Fairfax. We park her, let her cool. Everybody walks up the hill together, the band and me, but they can't see me. And now, the gig, the place is packed, the press is there. A month ago, a day ago, they didn't care, but there was something in the wind that morning, a message on the wind, a message that said to intended ears, the whiskey, tonight, the whiskey, tonight. Now the lights, the fog machine, the night. The love, the action, and I will not tell you more, only that things go very, very well. There is only one gig, one and done. Perfection cannot be repeated in this world. Each man performed to the fullest of his potential. Coogs dancing drove the crowd wild. Perry's soaring high notes returned and mesmerized. David's ballads made people weep openly.
You sheltered me from harm.
Sandy, better than ever. His drums gleaming. His sticks a blur of fury and redemption. Dive bomb and court hold their own, knowing they are not legends, but happy enough to stand next to them. And for the legends, Steve, David, Coog, and Sandy, from here on out was to be a very short time. Blaze of glory turned into a fireball at the bottom of a canyon ravine. A 77 Chevy Vega, like its driver, gone, still burning, crushed, smoking, the smell of the fried sage, as ancient as the oldies themselves, the burning oil, thick as tar pits holding their bones. No ash, no nothing, nothing. Just righteous preservation awaiting a monument, which is sure to be erected soon. The dream, the ride, at an end, but now we are all out here among the stars, angling with our minds between the planes, going where we wish, free and easy, making incredible, immortal rock and roll that will last forever.
This is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope. Stay tuned for Miracle Nutrition with Hardy White.
Oh, now I get it. You get it? Yeah, it took me a minute, but now I get it. It takes just a minute, and then you get it. Yeah, I didn't get it at first. Now I get it. I don't get it. Oh, you'll get it. Just give it a minute. Oh, I get it. See, it takes a minute, and then you get it. Yeah, you don't get it right away.
Wait, maybe I don't get it.
Oh, that happens. Sometimes you think you get it, then you don't get it. Wait for it.
Oh, I get it. Now I get it. Sorry, I get it.
See, I told you. All right. Well, all right. Now, moving on. Butchie, you have 3 minutes to rebut.
rebut.
What?
It's just funny to rebut. Oh, 3 minutes to rebut. Well, it's going to take me 2.5 minutes just to get the old butt off. But I guess I'll have to go to the butt store, get a new butt, so I could rebut.
All right, well, maybe we should just move on to the next question. Butchie, here's the question. Archbishop Fenelon and a chambermaid are in a boat. Something happens. I don't know what. And you can only save one. Who do you save?
Oh, that's easy. The boat. I don't know those two. So I'd save the boat so I could help my friends. Easy.
So you'd let them drown?
Yeah, but I'd have some nice funeral for him. I'd say some nice words. I'd probably stand on the boat there and say, Bishop Fenelon, Archbishop Fenelon, and the chambermaid provided us with so much blah, 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 tear up a little bit, then I'd take the boat and help my friends.
All right, Hardy, you've got 3 minutes to respond.
Respond? Oh, that's not... it's going to take me 2.5 minutes to get the old spawn off. No? All right. I also reject the question. I don't like those who-would-you-save things. I think that's a setup. It's steering you towards utilitarianism. I reject the question. I would save neither one of them. I would also save the boat, but then I would transform the boat into some sort of living being, like Pinocchio. I'd find some magic bug, and I'd say, this boat, I'm all alone in the world. Magic bug, could you turn this boat into a real live flesh-and-blood boat? It's kind of icky. I want it to have eyes and a mouth, though, so I can relate to it and say stuff to me and say, oh, Hardy, I'm your boat friend. Thank you, Bodie. Can I get in you and all? You've seen on children's shows a lot of times chairs and boats will talk and all. So, you know, I don't think it's not necessarily an inanimate object. It's pre-animate. It hasn't been animated yet. And now, today, with all the modern wizardry and magic that we have, it's probably something we can do. You know, a lot of times we see Star Trek or Star Wars or Starman. And they'd have all sorts of inventions. They'd say, oh, the future's going to be like that. And they say, oh, look, I have an iPhone or something. And then, see, that's how scientists get the ideas. They look back at the old shows and they look back at Lost in Space, and they'll say, that's what we need, is some kind of awful scientist there who's going to... No, not the robot. What we need is a robot whose head looks like a fishbowl or something, and that's how they get the ideas. And so I think that now with Harry Potter and all, we know that in the future there's going to be wizardry and everything. We'll be able to make plants talk and everything. It's going to be a wonderful world.
All right, I don't know if your 3 minutes are up, but I'm getting bored. Let's move on. Butchie, your question.
Shoot.
All right, let's say...